Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. This is the second part of a two-part interview with Hubert Selby Jr. Last week, we talked about his explosive first novel, Last Exit to Brooklyn, and today we're going to continue with the six books that so far comprise the rest of his career. The Last Exit to Brooklyn came out, and as I remember, it wasn't very long after before a section of the room appeared in the Evergreen Review. It was a rape by two policemen of a woman that they find. The section was possibly more disturbing than anything in Last Exit because perhaps it carried on what happened at the end of Last Exit, where the state, in the form of the corporation, is carrying on against the workers. Here we have the police against a woman. The novel was to be narrated by an innocent man who was jailed for that rape, aware that the police had committed it. It took 6 years before the book finally came out, and I'm curious because in every way, Last Exit is a wide canvas, a social novel with a vast number of characters. The Room is an interior novel. I suppose the inspiration for this kind of book is Dostoevsky's Notes from Underground, the book that occurs entirely within the head of the possibly mad, certainly obsessive narrator. 6 years. What was happening?
A lot of self-destruction, primarily. I guess I just was overwhelmed by the response to Last Exit, and I now had enough money to indulge myself to the point of death. And now I can see the fear behind it. I couldn't at the time. I just got caught up in that way of life. But eventually, I got back to work, and it took me 6 months to write The Room, which I have always felt was the most disturbing book ever written by a human being. And after I finished it, I stayed away from it for 12 years. Just the thought of reading it. And then I read it again, and I now think it's a masterpiece. But, oh, it's disturbing.
Well, I'll tell you, the book came out. I got a copy of it the week it came out. I was very eager. One had been waiting for it. And I found it, and this is a place where I want to talk about the book's relation to the reader or the book's relation to me. I found it to be terrifying, but not only terrifying, mesmerizing. And not only mesmerizing, but kind of erotically overwhelming. I don't know what it was in the culture at that time, but it seemed as if sadomasochism of various sorts had begun to be emblematic for so many of the power relationships in America. And so many of the way people who did not have power, and if you want the essence of powerlessness, be literary. but there it was, you know, a pileup of books known as avant-garde that included Naked Lunch, say. There were quite a few others, good and bad, you know, many of them published by Grove Press, which had gotten the nickname of the Dirty Book of the Month Club. And inside this book was a multi-parted fantasia, an S&M training session in which the jailed narrator is training the guilty policemen who have not been prosecuted to become police dogs. He's tying them up, he's torturing them, he's feeding them dog food. And it was a very strange relationship that I had to this reading. It both titillated and horrified me.
Now, it just occurred to me as you were speaking, perhaps the reason I could write directly about some of the subjects in that book was because I wasn't writing directly about the subjects. That book, the conception was purely musical, variations on a theme. That was it. More along the classical sense of variations rather than the jazz sense. So in other words, these events were secondary or even tertiary to the main thrust as I'm experiencing it, until that part about the dog suddenly came up on the paper. I had never expected that. I wasn't working towards that, and I've never had an experience like that in my entire life. It was just suddenly on the paper, and my immediate reaction was, oh, no, I'm not going to write this. But I can't do that because I've made a commitment to my art and to myself that if it comes to mind, it goes on the paper. And I can always throw it away. So I wrote it out. As a matter of fact, it came out in one big, long sequence. Oh, it's dreadful. I mean, just really dreadful. And when I finished, it worked. I chopped it up, spread it around the book. It worked, so it had to stay in, regardless of how I feel about it. I may want it out of there, but there's something else within me that says, nope, this works.
Now, this book, in a sense, affected not just this reader, Michael Silverblatt. You're listening to Bookworm, and my guest is Hubert Selby Jr., Cubby Selby, his nickname. But I think it affected all of American publishing. As I remember correctly, The Demon was written, but it couldn't find a publisher until, I think, Playboy Press
picked
it up. And maybe they published six books, or, you know, it was a brand new and unsuccessful venture for them. And this has led, I think, to a whole and a very unusual condition. There are certainly contemporary writers who publishers find it hard to publish. This happened to some extent to Kathy Acker. It happened to Dennis Cooper. There are books that are now published by the authors themselves. I think Henry Rollins has a press in order to facilitate the publication of difficult material. But in your case, it was, in a sense, so extreme that there was no American publisher for some time, and the book started being published by Marion Boyers in London. I had met her years ago when she was still working with John Calder. They were the publishers there in England of Samuel Beckett. Most of the significant avant-garde writing, the wonderful writing, was being published by Calder and Boyers. They split apart, and Marion Boyers has published most of the subsequent books, and they do not have an American publisher. And as I understand it, they seek one. It's not as if, I mean, we're talking years and years after the fact of the power of the room and its ability to remove even enthusiastic readers like me from these domains. Now, does this in some way, because it is so emblematic of what's happened to literature and the way in which we want to disown it and disown almost anything that hurts us unbearably. In other words, these books literally became the repressed. And like the repressed, they go buried for a certain period of time, And like the repressed, you can't keep it buried. They've all come back into print. They're all available now. And I would say that because of the great vehicle of freedom from repression, the movies, that with the movie of Last Exit to Brooklyn and of the fourth novel, Requiem for a Dream, there was suddenly the awareness that Hubert Selby Jr. was a writer who had never been forgotten but was not allowed really to be heard from subsequently. And I'm very curious about what this does to a writer.
I don't know about anybody else, but I'll tell you the truth. Every now and then, I come to tears over this whole thing. Now, of course, I'm not a kid projecting I'm going to do this or that. I'm 74. I've been writing for about 45 years or, you know, close to that, somewhere in that area. And I stay true to my vision simply because that's the way I am. I mean, I'm not looking for any laurel wreath for this. But that's just, I can't do it any other way. And I'm told by people in Europe that I'm a good writer, I'm great, I'm this and that and the other thing. And in this country, it's Hubert who? I mean, for instance, I've tried to get grants. I've tried a Guggenheimer a couple of times. What is it called? A Rockefeller, NEA a couple of times. I couldn't buy a $10,000 grant with 20 grand. I mean, they seem to loathe and despise me, the literary community. But the thing that I have is the respect of my peers, which, of course, is really, in many ways, far more valuable.
Yeah. And then comes a very different book called The Willow Tree. You've called it the first book where you self-consciously set out to create and write about a spiritual experience, a miracle of a sort.
I've always been enamored with the mountain men, you know, Liver-Eating Johnson and Lord Grizzly and those people. So I figured, well, I'll make this an urban thing. I'll have this young black kid who's a regular Liver-Eating Johnson looking for revenge and so forth. And so I'm still working on the problems of the heart, the mind, you know. And at the same time, I want to show how you get from the darkness to the light. So what is the antithesis of a 13-year-old black kid? How about an old Jewish guy from the camps? You know?
Moshe.
Yeah, and it has to be, because who else would Bobby listen to? He can't help himself but listen to this guy. And for one thing, he doesn't preach to him. But he knows, that Bobby knows this guy had hurt. So, and I love Bobby. I mean, he is so hip the way he goes about getting these guys. Oh, but he doesn't know it. But the message is getting through from Moishe. And Moishe simply says, wish him the best.
Well, it's fascinating that just at the time that this literature of transgression is gaining some kind of public presence. In fact, I'm given myself credit for coining this term in the dictionary of all the things, that you come up with The Willow Tree, which is a book of conscience. You know, conscience, not only conscience, but conscience, raw conscience, conscience exposed in the most unimaginable way. A young person who has been deformed by a gang attack, his girlfriend has had lye thrown in her face, and now he's talking forgiveness with an old Jew from the concentration camps. Now, almost anyone who would hear this would say, oh, no, I can't. I mean, and you're saying to me that a master of the avant-garde, of the transgressive, has put this together. Now, this is the most peculiar thing. I mean, this is this is a book that the man who knows not to give anyone a happy ending writes to ensure that there's not a happy ending to his own dilemmas as a writer, because this is a book which, while apparently it's going to satisfy everyone's desire to see Hubert Selby redeemed and to see his subjects given the balm of forgiveness and forgetfulness and salvation. But no, it's not going to happen in that way, because these characters are not philosophers. Mm-hmm. They're not capable of the forgiveness that they preach. And so they're caught in a deeper trap than any of the others have been. Am I right in thinking about it in this way?
Well, I don't know that they can't do what they preach, because certainly Moshe did. That's how Moshe got to where he is, was by doing what Saul suggested. Wish him well. He resisted that, until the pain of resisting it was far greater than the pain of indulging it. So he did it. Bobby hasn't reached that point yet. We don't know if he ever will, really. I guess it depends upon the individual. I hope he will. I mean, he did not kill that kid. Raul, I think his mm-hmm. name is. He did not kill him, so there's hope. At least we think there's hope that maybe he'll come around. I don't know. But like Hemingway said, isn't it pretty to think so?
In the sun also rises. Now, finally, this past year, a new novel from Cubby Selby, Hubert Selby Jr., Waiting Period, came out from Marion Boyers. And once again, it's a book of internalized paradox, otherwise known as a joke. Someone who thinks to kill himself has to wait 5 days before the computer can process his form and he can get the gun and its license, and he decides that if he killed himself, he would have been killing the wrong person, and that there are people, not least the rat at the VA who won't grant his allowance, who should be killed, and he develops a way to go about killing, and in fact is so good at it that he feels that he has found his purpose in life. He becomes a mass murderer, a serial murderer, rather, mm-hmm. although he...
And a serious murderer.
And a serious murderer. And eventually, someone very much like God begins contributing passages in italics to Waiting Period by my guest Hubert Selby Jr., complimenting this killer on his anonymity, on his selflessness, on his ability to bust the ego, to take first things first, to take it easy. we're watching what seems to be the apotheosis of someone who's learned morality from a 12-step program, but taking it to a maximal point where even God is approving of his impulse to correct society through slaughter, which is akin to what I think is probably this author's belief, that God approves of this author's attempt to correct society through literature. In other words, it answers a problem that you've talked about in various interviews, that these books, each time you sit down to write one, reveals the tear or the wound, that the work has its goal in holiness, but its methods are profane. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that this book, Waiting Period, is almost, you know, the serial killings in this book are like the novels.
Well, that's one reason why the book is dedicated to the Inquisition. after all, the writer is allowed to make a statement here and there, and I'm kind of disassociating myself from this guy and saying. But you see, one of the things that I love in writing is have a first-person narration. Well, it doesn't have to be, but to have an individual reveal things about themselves that they have no idea they're revealing. This fellow does not know that he really doesn't know. He's exactly the same as the people he's cursing.
Mm-hmm. You know? Well, he becomes their double.
Yeah, he does.
He becomes a bureaucrat.
He doesn't realize it. He doesn't see it at all. And that was part of the fascination for me in writing the book, to have him reveal things about himself that he thinks are reprehensible in everybody else.
From the very beginning in Last Exit to Brooklyn, the epigraphs to the sections reveal that you know and apply the Bible in ways that are more in the spirit of the harshness and austerity of the Bible than one expects to find. In other words, Hubert Selby's Bible is not a friendly book. So I wanted to talk to you about, in this close, about the real God who makes his appearance in these epigraphs and the false God who seems to be speaking to the narrator of Waking Period.
Well, I don't know about calling the God in the epigraphs the real God. I don't believe that's the real God. As a matter of fact, that's one of the things that drove me nuts as a kid. Periodically, I'd read the Old Testament thinking I was going to find God in there, and I'd end up throwing the book against the wall, kicking it, I mean, just savagely treating this poor book. So I don't know that that's the real. I don't think of it as the real God, and I certainly don't. I'm just saying the same thing in Waiting Period I've been saying all along. I'm just doing it in a different way.
So where does, or does the question of godliness get addressed in these books?
I don't know that it ever does, really. I think it's certainly accurate to say there is a lack of God. But again, the word God is so tough. It depends on how you define God, and I just don't like the word.
Well, I notice, in fact, that the word is never really used. He's spelled G-A-W-D sometimes, uh-huh, or K-R-I-S-T sometimes, but a name of an actual God is, uh-huh, never invoked, as far as I can see, only in his slang misappellations.
Yeah.
And yet one feels, and even if one hadn't felt it, there are statements from the author that these are to some extent holy or spiritual books. And that's the question I wanted to address.
Are you sure it's from the author and not from the narrator?
I know that the narrator of Waiting Period is not Hubert Selby Jr., nor are his ideas about God Hubert Selby Jr.'s ideas. And I know with each book there's been a period of disclaimer. I am not Harry Black or Harry White or Harry Wright or any of the innumerable Harrys who narrate these things. But in the long run, it would seem to me of limited satisfaction to be presenting a series of straw dogs, each of them, you know, trying the best they can, miserable sinners that they are, with the writer, the artist, outside. And certainly the books wouldn't have the preoccupation they have with evil, with violence, with alienation, and disgust, if they weren't seeking something else or seeking in these subjects a way of seeing or being. The message does not seem to be that life is insufferable. The direction, including Willow Tree, does not seem to be that life is without spiritual recourse. So where does the artist stand? Not within the pages of the book, but with relation to these projects of the howls of alienated individuals.
One of the basic things about the changing of the voice and that sort of thing is I never want to write the same book twice. And no matter what it is I write, no matter what it is I may consciously want to do or avoid doing, things get in there that I'm unaware of. That's just human nature. You can't avoid that. But I believe, with the artist, when the conscious element coincides and meshes perfectly with the unconscious, it creates an overtone, what we call a work of art. So although I may be disagreeing on many levels with what the people in the books are doing or not doing, I think the same basic search, Covey's search, my search for meaning, can be found there. Might be a little tricky, because I think, you know, when a writer writes well, you can't be sure who's on first. But but certainly, I believe that my personal quest can be found going through my work. I don't think I could avoid that even if I tried.
Is your quest separate from the work?
Well, that's a good question. I've never thought of that. I don't see how it can be, considering how I feel about my work, considering the fact that I believe it doesn't take much, only everything I got. Absolutely everything of me has to be in there. You can't avoid, I don't think I can avoid it, even if I thought of it.
I've been talking with Hubert Selby Jr., author most recently of Waiting Period, published by Marion Boyers. Thank you for joining me.
It's been a great pleasure, Michael.
You can read the first section of Waiting Period on the Bookworm page at kcrw.com. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Ray Guarna. Special production assistance from Alan Howard and Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com, keyword bookworm. Cassette copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Everything, they're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with book, off the mouse, pop,
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.